Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Fascinating guest this week, as always, Paul Gilmartin, the host of the Mental Illness Happy Hour podcast. We get into some really, really interesting, gritty areas. And speaking of that, I want to just issue a little disclaimer at the top here. Some of this stuff is quite gritty. I think very brave, but quite gritty. And I just want to warn you in advance that that if you're feeling sensitive today, maybe not the best thing for you, because he talks a lot about his own personal struggles with mental illness and abuse. And if you're listening to this with little kids in the vehicle or in the space, then you maybe go to another episode just for now. But it's great and powerful stuff. Paul Gilmartin is coming up. But first, a quick item of business and your voicemails. The business item is that we're hiring. Not here at the podcast, but at the 10% Happier app company, we're hiring. If you like what we do, we are actually looking for a software developer, a digital marketer, and some content producers at our offices in Boston. So you can learn more at jobs.10%happier.com. Jobs.10%happier.com. All right, let's do some phone calls. Here's my usual caveat, which is you may be tired of me saying this, but I feel compelled to say it anyway. I'm not a meditation teacher, just a reporter who writes about meditation and does some meditation. I'm not a mental health expert. I answer these questions on the voicemails to the best of my ability. I have not heard them in advance, so I reserve the right to be completely wrong. Here's voicemail number one.
Hi, Dan. I just finished listening to your TM episode with Bob Roth, and I really, really dug it. I've been skeptical about it forever. I've been doing mindfulness meditation for a long time now. And after listening to that podcast, I feel ready to try it and to go forward with it. I also was really blown away that you had said that you were ready for this. And so that was big too. I want to know if you've done it, and I want to know how it went, and I want to know if you learned from Bob Roth. And just to drop it like that, saying, hey, I'm going to learn it from you, when you're one of the biggest skeptics I know about all of this also, I need answers to those questions. So I hope the TM experience went really well. How that went with you could really impact a lot of us out there that are looking to broaden our meditation practice. So I hope you get around to this one. Thank you. This is Francie Cashman. I also follow you on Twitter. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Frankie. Appreciate it. Bad news is I've done nothing. I'm a horrible, lazy person. I'm horribly overscheduled is really the problem. I haven't done anything, but I'm still in touch with Bob. We email not infrequently, and I will do it. I'm very interested in trying it. I am. I'm not skeptical of the practice. I mean, he might quibble with what I'm about to say, but basically the TM practice is also known as Vedic meditation, where you use a mantra. It's been around for like 3,000 years, maybe more. So I'm not super skeptical that and there's some science that suggests it's really good for you. So I'm not super skeptical of the practice. As you may have heard in the podcast with Bob Roth, who's the head of the David Lynch Foundation and also a very high-ranking official within the Transcendental Meditation Organization, I do have some questions about the organization and the founder, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who made some kind of interesting claims. I like Bob personally, I'd be happy to go learn from him, and I retain the right to retain my skepticism on various aspects. But again, I really do think I've seen no evidence to suggest that the practice is not a healthy one, and a significant amount of evidence to suggest it is a healthy one. So I'm glad you're checking it out, and you know, my view basically on meditation is that while I, you know, it's easy to fall into kind of sectarian ruts, but you know, I'm pro meditation generally. I do happen to practice Buddhist meditation or you know, at times what might be referred to as secular mindful meditation, which is derived from Buddhism, but is stripped of the sort of metaphysical stuff. I do the Buddhist variety, although I am agnostic on all the metaphysical claims. I've seen no evidence personally for reincarnation, et cetera, et cetera. But just because I am a Buddhist, it doesn't mean I I'm super like dogmatic about, you know, that's the only kind of meditation you should do. I think what we know now is that the mind is trainable. That's the big deal. The mind is trainable. And there are lots of ways to do that, lots of kinds of meditation. And so I think you should sniff around, find the one that's best for you, and give that a shot. And then over time, once you have a grounding in one kind of meditation, well, then I think that it might make sense to kind of do a little broadening. And you've got a firm foundation. You can then try to diversify your practice. So I said a lot without actually without giving you satisfaction on what you really wanted, which was, what was it like for me when I got trained by Bob Roth? Haven't done that yet, but I know that I will at some point. All right, call number two.
Hey, Dan, this is John calling from Lebanon, Pennsylvania. First and foremost, great job so far. You're doing amazing work, so I much appreciate it from over here in Lebanon. My question for you is, I find myself having an easier time being mindful and doing my meditation practice on the weekends when things are easy going and there's no work. I guess my question for you is, do you experience the same things when it's the weekend and you're not doing your day job? I know you're a busy man, but or do you have mechanisms in place to get you back into the zone when you are going through stress? Or I imagine when you come back through or come back from a retreat, you're probably in a nice state of mind, but then the real world happens, and then you might feel anxious or not in the present. So do you have any ways to get yourself back in the present moment when you are experiencing moments of stress, specifically during the work week and not during the easy moments in life, like the weekends and retreats and things like that? Thanks, Dan. Much appreciated, man.
This is really important. You've put your finger on a really important thing. So I have a lot to say about this. First of all, I work on the weekends. So for me, there's never a weekend because I work on Saturday and Sunday mornings doing weekend GMA here at ABC News, but also during the week, not only am I doing Nightline, I'm also co-founder of this 10% Happier company. So I'm working all the time. And I'm straying a little bit from what we really want to talk about here, but I don't want to make that sound like I'm complaining. I'm not, actually. I love everything I do. I often describe it as drowning in chocolate, because everything I'm working on is so exciting to me. But there is certainly at times the aspect of drowning. So that's something I really kind of have to keep my eye on and make sure that I've got enough balance. Ongoing discussion, of course, with my wife and in my own head. Anyway, the what you put your finger on that is really important is that there are times when it seems like you have a quote unquote better meditation because, for in your case, it's on the weekend. For most people, it's the weekend. There's less going on. And you're in a calmer state of mind. But that actually, in my view, is a bit of a misconception. That's why I said quote unquote better. Because you've had an easier, calmer, less distracted sit, maybe even a more physically comfortable sit because you're less stressed and stress can show up in the body. That doesn't mean it's actually better, in my view. In fact, there can be real value, in my opinion, and in my experience, to the sits that we think were tough, or where you're totally distracted because you've just come out of a busy meeting, or you've just finished a busy day, or you're heading into a busy day, and you're just ambushed by all these thoughts of anger over what was said or what was not said, planning for what you have to do, rumination over things you maybe did poorly, blah, 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 blah. That is like, actually, if you think about it, like exercise, that's like a really tough workout, you know, and instead of, you know, pedaling through the countryside at a leisurely pace, that's like, going to Barry's boot camp or CrossFit where you're getting your butt kicked. And that's training for life, where anything can happen at any time, and we are not control. We are not in control. We're living in a universe that, as I often say, is characterized by impermanence and entropy. And we need that training to be, you know, supple in the face of how unpredictable our minds are and how unpredictable the exterior world is, which, of course, is all refracted through the lens of our mind anyway. So I wouldn't get too hung up on this. And by the way, I do it too, so no judgment here. But so I my advice is I wouldn't get too hung up on what you perceive to be a good sit versus a bad sit. Do it consistently on all days of the week, if you can, or most days of the week, so that you're training in the calm times and in the less than calm times. What's the point here? The point is not to, as Sharon Salzberg, the master meditation teacher, has said, the point of meditation is not to become some great meditator. The point is to become better at life. So, yeah, I think it's really important what you've zeroed in on there, and hopefully I've given you a useful reframing. And I know I said this at the beginning, but, you know, just bear in mind that these are better questions. These are questions that are – I'm stealing wisdom from people who really do know what they're talking about, but I hope I'm stating it correctly, and I'm really speaking from my own experience here. But if you have access to great meditation teachers wherever you live, or if you're on the 10% Happier app and you can talk to one of our coaches who are much more experienced meditators than me, that those are even better people to put the question to. But again, I think the right way to think about meditation is don't get so focused on trying to reach some special state. Just get better and better and better, as you will inevitably through the practice, at seeing clearly whatever you're feeling right now, so that your feelings generally don't yank you around like a malevolent puppeteer. All right, let's get to our guest this week. Just such a great guy, Paul Gilmartin. He's a stand-up comedian. You may have seen him for a long time. He was a host of a hit show on TBS called Dinner in a Movie. But he has, for a long time, struggled with mental illness. I mean, really serious struggles, and you're going to hear him talk about it. And he's decided in recent years to kind of make that the focus of his professional life. So he's still funny, but he's very funny in the context I'm about to discuss, which is that he started a podcast called The Mental Illness Happy Hour, where it's totally cool to talk about all of this, mental illness of all flavors and all varieties, and it's not pretty, but it also can be funny. It also, of course, is really sad and frustrating and poignant, and Paul does it all. He is, of course, a meditator as well, and he's lots of stories about how that has and has not worked for him. So here he is, Paul Gilmartin. How, when, and why did you start meditating?
I first started meditating about 7 years ago. There was a woman in my support group who was a hot mess.
Wait, hold on a second. Support group for what?
For addiction.
All right. I'm going to call in an audible here. Let's detour into that for just a moment before we get to the meditation. Addiction to what?
Alcohol, drugs.
And which drugs?
Mostly weed and then beer and wine. Those were my things. But I was kind of a garbage can. I would do, you know, if somebody had mushrooms or coke or whatever, I would do them. But I didn't seek any of that stuff out.
That's interesting to me as a former abuser of cocaine. So you could casually do cocaine but not chase it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Everybody's brain is different.
It's interesting. Uppers have never really been my thing. And I, you know, to take another detour, after battling treatment-resistant depression for since essentially 1999, my psychiatrist recommended Adderall, and being a recovering addict, I thought, no way. And then I met somebody in my support group who had been sober as long as I had, and she said, you know, I was skeptical, but I tried it, and I didn't, because it wasn't her drug of choice, she said, I have no desire to abuse it, and it has been a game changer. And so I tried Adderall, and it has been a game changer.
Really? Because I've been tempted to abuse Adderall.
Yeah.
So it just speaks to different proclivities.
I think so. I think so.
We should define what – can you tell people what Adderall is?
Yeah, Adderall is speed, essentially. It's a methamphetamine, and it helps me with that feeling I used to get every day after being up for about 4 hours that I had to lay down because the world was just too much. And yeah, it's I'm more productive. I'm on like a medium dose of it.
But it's normally prescribed not for depression, but for ADD, right?
Yeah, yeah. But they've discovered that it can help with treatment-resistant depression. So I'm so glad I gave it a shot because it's depression is it can be so tenacious and yeah,
no question. So we're deeply embedded in a tertiary tributary here.
I've got a flow chart.
Okay, so let's disembed from this third one, which was about uppers, and back to the secondary detour, which was about your
addiction.
So how long had that been going on?
I mean, I started smoking pot and drinking when I was about 14, but I was a pretty high-functioning drug addict, alcoholic. For instance, I didn't drink during the day. There were many nights I could have two or three drinks and be okay. But it progressed. As I got into my 30s, I began not knowing what was going to happen if I drank. I might be fine or I might be driving home with one eye closed because I'm seeing double. And I've never had a DUI. I've never lost a job because of it. I didn't lose any of the external stuff, but my bottom was really an internal, emotional bottom where I was thinking about suicide 50 times a day.
Wow.
And this was in the middle of doing a 16-year run on a TV show, and you know it was going great. I was making more money than I ever had.
What was the show?
Dinner and a Movie. It was a show on TBS from 95 to 2011. And essentially the show was we would show a movie and then you would see us in the break right before the commercial for 2 minutes, you know, maybe six times throughout the movie. And we would be doing the steps of a recipe themed around the movie we would be showing. And, you know, we'd crack jokes and give cooking tips and talk about the movie. And, yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was really kind of in many ways a dream gig, but my depression was being exacerbated so much by the alcohol abuse that it was smiling for, you know, a full day on camera, and it was mostly improvised, so I really had to kind of be focused. It was like, felt like lifting 500 pounds to me. As soon as they would yell cut, my face would drop. And it was just, so much of my life was filled with a dread of facing the day. So getting sober in 2003, honestly, because I thought I was going to kill myself if I didn't, that gave my meds a chance to start to work. And so they did, but there was always kind of this last 25% that I couldn't seem to get over. And that's kind of where the Adderall helped. That's where the meditation helped. It's where going to another support group for intimacy issues helped. So there's so many things that I have in my regimen to be functional and at peace. But because I'm used to doing them, I don't even think about it anymore. It's just a part of my routine.
It's a healthy habit. So almost by definition, so you've gotten us very smoothly back to square one in the story. So you're saying 7 years ago, there was a woman in your support group who was a hot mess.
A hot mess, yes. And talking a mile a minute, kind of just wound up.
And which support group was this?
The one for drugs and alcohol.
Okay, so not the intimacy one.
No.
Okay.
And she came in one day, and she was a different person. And she was so much more chill. And I said, "You seem different." And she said, "I started meditating." And I said, how did you learn how to do that?" And she said, "Well, the type of meditation I learned how to do is transcendental meditation." And she got really into it, and she became a teacher. And I said, "Can you teach me?" And so she did, and I told her, "I'm really skeptical, because in transcendental meditation, there's some ceremony involved in the first time they teach you how to do it." And I just, like, I've always recoiled at, you know, the anything remotely new agey, you know. Somebody mentions Mother Earth and I'm out of there, you know. They start overusing the word sacred and I just shut down.
Yeah.
There was a tiny
bit. How do you deal with finger symbols?
Say that again?
How do you deal with finger symbols? You like those?
I don't understand.
Dream catchers, didgeridoo music, any of that work for you?
Oh, didgeridoo. Oh, my God. Actually, I don't mind the didgeridoo. But the, you know, the classic kind of Sonoma, you know, the guru.
Sedona,
in a,
yes.
In a robe.
Yes.
I don't know. It's just a little too precious for me.
No, I hear you. So anyway, the TM, it did or did not work?
Did work.
Okay.
And she said, "I recommend you do it 2 times a day, 20 minutes each time. Find a quiet place. You know, take your phone out of your pocket, your keys, your wallet. Sit down, close your eyes." And she gave me a mantra, which is part of transcendental meditation. And you just repeat the mantra in your mind. Or you could say it out loud if you wanted as well. And it's a phrase that has no meaning. And that's the point of it, is that it disengages your brain from thinking about your day, thinking about, you know, whatever it is. And I think it was the third day I was doing it. It was after my afternoon session. I went to go wash the dishes. And up until then, any kind of household chore had always felt like the 60 minutes clock was going in my head. Like these were things that were in the way of my life. And I had to plow through these to get to the point, the good parts of my life. And I suddenly felt so relaxed and present that I realized that doing the dishes were a part of my life, and there's no reason why I can't give it my full attention and try to find something pleasurable in doing it. And I swear to you, Dan, it felt as I was washing the dishes, and maybe it was just because I slowed down, but it felt like my arms were moving through water, just like this, like this flow. And I went, wow, something is working. This is not a bunch of BS. And I became sold on it. Now, I don't do the afternoon one anymore. I slowly got away from that, and I wish I could get back to doing it, but I have been unable to get back to that second meditation. But I meditate every morning after I shower, and there's a lot of days, honestly, it's 20 minutes of me thinking about myself with my eyes closed. But one of the things she stressed is there's no bad meditation.
We've had on the show Bob Roth, who's the head of the David Lynch Foundation, longtime transcendental meditation teacher, 50 years, I think, something like that.
Wow.
But he says, even in a shallow dive, you get wet.
I love that.
What would you say in the simplest possible terms for somebody who's got a long history of dealing with depression is the utility of transcendental meditation for you? In the context of this overwhelming depression?
One of the side effects of depression for me and a lot of people I know is the ruminating on, I've got to get out of this depression. And it almost creates a, maybe the anxiety was there always along with it, but there is often an anxiety to just facing the day because you've got this 50-pound backpack on your brain. And meditation has helped me let go of my ideas of how things should be and to kind of be more conscious about being in the present moment and just meeting it where it's at. You know, whether I just got in a car accident or, you know, I had a fight with a friend, it helps me step outside of my brain instead of seeing all of my thoughts as fact and reality. And so it sounds kind of weird, but it has helped me not take what I'm feeling personally and add too much of it, almost like a way of, instead of being in a traffic jam, being in the helicopter looking down at the traffic jam.
Perfect. Yeah, it's perfect. Exactly. You're stepping out of the stream. You're stepping out of the story. And yeah, even if it, for a few nanoseconds at a time, to see it with some non-judgmental remove so that it doesn't own you.
Yeah, and you begin to realize when you experience those moments where the anxiety slips away, you begin to realize, oh, it's not I am anxious, it's I'm experiencing some anxiety, and it's something that is flowing through me, and I can witness it and not judge it. I can even self-reflect and say what might be causing this. But meditation is really good, really helpful for me for distinguishing between self-obsession and self-reflection, because the latter is super healthy and the former is really destructive. You know, I had an epiphany a couple of years into sobriety that nothing degrades the quality of my life like obsessing about the quality of my life. And meditation is so good about introducing yourself to what you're obsessing about, because when you find your thoughts wandering and you know, part of the practice is bringing them back to either your breath or your mantra, well, if you notice 50 times in 20 minutes you're going to I've got to make the podcast more successful, you can't help but understand, oh, I'm feeling some anxiety about my podcast. You know, what might be the fear underneath it? So it also helps me investigate what's going on inside me. It serves so many different purposes.
Well, you brought us to the podcast. Let's talk about that.
I prefer not to talk about that.
I suspect that's not true. It's such an interesting show. I don't want to describe it because I'm not going to do it justice. Can you just talk about the genesis of the show and what it's grown into?
In 2010, late 2010, I went off my meds despite my psychiatrist strongly urging me not to. And I thought I was, you know, out of the woods, felt great. And then at about 5 months, the depression snuck back in, but I didn't see it for what it was. I thought, oh, my life really does suck. I will never be able to experience joy again because this is just who I am. And I wanted to kill myself. And then it occurred to me, oh, my God, this is the depression. And I thought, I've been in therapy for years and years. I've been in support groups. I see a psychiatrist. I believe mental illness is a real thing. And I was fooled by it. And I thought, somebody has to talk about this in a way that is accessible, because there was the kind of academic dry way that I didn't feel was accessible. And then there was the kind of precious new agey way that turned me off. And I thought, what if you just talked about all the battles in our heads in a way that was raw, uncensored, just how two close friends would laugh and cry about how screwed up their lives are that day, or how screwed up they feel. And because in support groups, I realized the power of hearing someone's story that you relate to is worth, you know, dozens of therapy sessions, dozens of books, because it brought the thing that I needed most in my darkest hours, which was comfort and knowing that I'm not alone. And that helps with the anxiety. That helps build momentum for recovery. And so that's what I tried to do with the podcast. And as it began growing, I realized, wow, the listeners have some really interesting stories as well. And I started recording listeners as well as, you know, friends of mine, fellow comedians, therapists, authors. Yeah, and so it's just kind of grown. So the podcast is half conversation, like I had with you. If you haven't listened to Dan's episode yet, it's great. And the other half of the podcast is listener confessions, which I read. They fill it out anonymously via about a dozen surveys we have on the website. And I pick some surveys to read for each episode, and they're mind-blowing.
They are. Yeah. I will say, having listened to them. Tell me about the name.
The Mental Illness Happy Hour.
And so you were trying to... Go ahead.
Yes. I wanted to try to find a title that when people saw it, they would go, oh, this is about the battle in our heads, but it doesn't take itself too seriously.
Okay. Right. You were trying to get that middle ground between new agey and sterile.
Yeah. And the logo also, I think, gets that across. It's a 60s station wagon, and on the luggage rack is a gigantic prescription bottle.
So because when I first came across it, I thought, maybe a little flip. But then you listen to it, and it just oozes realness, you know. Thanks. And I listened to this, and I thought, oh, this is probably helping a lot of people.
You know, I don't want to toot my own horn, but I get really, really beautiful feedback from people who say that it helps them. And which brings me to another topic, which is meaning and purpose, which has been every bit as important as, for me, meds, exercise, support groups, meditation, boundaries. There was a feeling I was always chasing when I was working as a stand-up comedian and a TV host, that I would reach some level of money or fame where I would suddenly feel like, okay, I can relax now. And I realized, now, here's a telling example of the way my brain works. Whenever I would drive down Sunset Boulevard, I would look at billboards of people on there, and I would think, they've made it. It's official. They're on a billboard on Sunset Boulevard. If I could just get my face on a billboard on Sunset Boulevard, then I would feel like, you know, it's official. I've made it. Because I would always say, well, my show's on basic cable. We show a movie, so, you know, really the movie is the star. On and on and on. Just ways to obsess about myself. But one year, the show took out a billboard on Sunset Boulevard. And so I drove down to look at it, and I looked at it, and I lost respect for Sunset Boulevard.
It's like that Groucho Marx joke. Yeah, I don't want to be a member of any club that would have somebody like me as a member.
Exactly.
Much more of our conversation right after this quick break. This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. I got to tell you, I feel so much better when I talk about my anxiety instead of keeping it bottled up. There's an expression that I first heard from the great researcher and also Zen practitioner Robert Waldinger: never worry alone. Our temptation many times is to keep it bottled up, but the data really show that the people who do the best in life, who live the longest and are the happiest, have strong relationships with people with whom they can talk about whatever's going on in their lives. And for me, therapy is part of that. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happier today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/happier. As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction.
You buy Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings with screener questions, then sort, review, and communicate with candidates from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire.
There's a lot coming at you right now. Turmoil, tweets, an insane amount of chatter. I'm Brad Milkey with ABC News, and I'm here to throw you a lifeline. It's a new podcast called Start Here, where our experts give you on-the-ground access to the biggest stories of the day. We're going to give you some context, some clarity among the chaos. 20 minutes every weekday. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and start here.
What you're describing is It's like what the Buddha had in mind when he said, when he described suffering, that suffering is, well, it's many things, but one of them is thinking that the thing you want is going to finally do it for you.
Yep. And if I hadn't been forced to go to support groups to stay alive, I wouldn't have discovered the power of helping. I wouldn't have discovered the power of being vulnerable, of asking for help, humbling myself. And I suddenly had a different perspective on my life, because when I would help someone else who was just like me, I found the peace that I thought I was going to experience from business success. And that was a game changer for me.
So does that mean, like, you, what does that mean? You like become a monk, or what's the logical extension of that?
No, I stopped obsessing about what I think my path needs to look like. How many Twitter followers I have, or how often I'm going on an audition, or how much I'm being paid. I surrendered to the fact that I can't control any of those things. I can do some footwork maybe to try to nudge them, but sitting and obsessing about that all day and being in a bad mood, you know, when I see somebody else having what I want, is not making my life any better. So why don't I just do the things that bring me peace? And I discovered that when the dinner and movie got canceled in 2011, I had just started doing the podcast about 6 months earlier, and I thought, I really love doing the podcast. And I'm getting kind of tired of going on the road and doing stand-up and going on auditions for TV. I kind of feel like this podcast is where I'm supposed to be, because I feel such meaning and purpose from it. And I have always believed, or at least since I got sober, that when you feel peace, that is kind of a breadcrumb on the trail to your most authentic self. And so I've just followed that. And sure enough, I'm able to support myself now doing the podcast. And I feel like everything I've been through in my life that has been difficult has been necessary for me to be able to do this show, which helps people and really helps me.
So are you saying you're not saying that you no longer, because you said the opposite earlier. I think you're not saying that you no longer obsess about your Twitter followers or how your podcast is doing, et cetera, because you said earlier that sometimes...
Not as much.
Okay.
Not as much as I used to obsess about my show business career. You know, there's still, those thoughts still come up, but now I'm able to be the helicopter looking down at them and say, okay, there's probably some negative self-belief going on here, which is that I'm not enough, that I need to feel special to be safe. And I know that those are all thoughts that have not worked in my favor. You know, what has worked in my favor is the stuff that they teach you in meditation, which is to be present, practice principles that you believe in, and whatever the results are, meet them with a reaction that is principled.
When you say doing the podcast helps you, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, there was a thing that I went through the second year of the podcast where I began to give weight to stuff that had happened to me as a kid, that I was finally able to call covert incest. And it was... my relationship with my mom had always been enmeshed, and I kind of knew that, but my wife at the time, ex-wife now, would always say to me, you haven't given weight to what happened to you. You think you've dealt with the way your mom touches you, talks to you, looks at you, but you haven't. And when I was in the support group for intimacy, I began to peel away layers of the onion. You know, one of the ways that I used to soothe myself, especially after I stopped drinking, was pornography and video games. And when I started to cut back on those and unnumb myself, I began to give weight to what happened to me because I could feel in my body what I wouldn't allow myself to feel as a little boy, because when you're stuck in a situation, your brain will cope with whatever it needs to do to avoid the truth of I'm stuck in a house with a parent who is not safe, who is predatory towards my body. She never touched my genitals, but there was a lot of really inappropriate. You know, I'll give you one example, which is she took my temperature rectally until I was 8 years old and asked her, why are we still doing it this way? There's a bunch of other examples, and I could always explain away each one, but in 2012, I looked at the pattern as a whole, and I am getting back around to your question. This actually all leads to it. I had a meltdown when the truth of that finally hit me, and I wanted to die. And one of the things that abuse survivors struggle with is going back and forth in their mind about whether or not they're making too big of a deal of it. The things that my brain would tell me was, you're a baby. You're exaggerating, and you're doing this for attention. And then an hour later, I would feel completely differently, And it was a war going on in my brain, trying to hold on to the image of my mom I had created to survive as a child. So I began talking about this on the podcast. And
is she alive?
She is alive.
And did she hear this?
Yes. She I think in like 2014 or 15, I had cut contact with her because I couldn't be in the same room with her. I couldn't bear to even be on the phone with her. And then I tried having a communication through mail, but I asked for some boundaries to not be crossed, and she didn't respect them. And so I cut contact for good. And she did find out that I was talking about it. And I really agonized over whether or not I should talk about it. And the thing that I ultimately decided was, this is my story. And the more people that stay quiet about their abuse because they don't want someone to be hurt, the harder it is for them to heal, and the harder it is for somebody out there who was in a similar situation and has yet to give weight to their experience, the harder it is for them to heal. And it was a tough decision, but I thought it was the right thing to do. And I may regret it later on, but she was obviously upset. But then I think it sunk in, and she apologized, but it was also kind of not really taking responsibility for it and kind of blaming it on her childhood. And I know her childhood, which was horrible, contributed to it, but I wasn't looking for a reason why she did it. I wanted her to empathize with me and to show some type of concern about how might she help moving forward, how might she change and how she deals with me. And there wasn't any of that. You know, for instance, one day I had told her, I know you want to be closer to me, but I don't feel safe around you. And she wasn't interested in wanting to know why. She didn't even ask any questions. She didn't say anything. She just kind of looked through me. And so those were the things. It's not because she did those things to me as a kid that I don't have contact with her. I have empathy for her. I still love her, but I kind of look at it like a dog that bites. I love that dog. I wish it didn't bite, but I can't keep getting bitten. So talking about all of this stuff on the podcast, I got so much support from listeners, from therapists, and it helped me let go of the shame. It helped me own my story and go from feeling like a victim to a survivor. And here's, to me, a good example of how I feel about mothers who do this to their kids. The term covert incest was coined by a therapist. He wrote a book called Silently Seduced, which is an amazing, amazing book. And when he first started talking about this to his peers when he would be speaking, there was a lot of pushback. And like one woman, you know, shot up in the middle of his lecture and said, "This is preposterous." And but he just kept talking about it because he had so many clients who had experienced this kind of under the radar emotional enmeshment and crossing of boundaries in the bathroom and no privacy and kid being naked for reasons that were really questionable over and over. And then there was a woman who stood up at one of his lectures and said, thank you, thank you. I'm putting my son in therapy tomorrow. That woman is a hero to me. And that is the attitude I have towards people who have done that, is it's not about labeling them as bad or evil. It's about what can we do to help this not happen again, and for the people it's happened to, for them to heal. And so the podcast has helped me by helping other people heal. And the support I've gotten has helped me heal. A lot of moms who are listeners really, really helped me because they emailed me after I disclosed a lot of the things that I experienced. And they were like, that is not okay. And there was, you may have to edit this out because it's pretty harsh, but one mom sent me an email that said, I want to kick your mom in the it. While I don't want anybody to do that to my mom, I was moved by that protection that woman felt for that little boy that I was. And it made me realize that's the kind of protection a kid should have. He shouldn't be worried about defending himself. And the podcast helped me with all of that, as well as therapy and support groups.
So given the weight and the seriousness of the issues that you're discussing on the show, even if you're trying to do it in a way that sometimes has levity mm-hmm. to it, you know, do you ever get communications that, I mean, you must imagine this happens a lot, where you feel like, oh, well, you actually need to maybe call the cops to prevent somebody from hurting themselves or something like that?
I have, they've been very few and far between, because one of the things I've discovered is, are you talking about because somebody's suicidal or because they're abusing somebody?
I meant more suicidality.
Yes, and I always write and say, I am so sorry that you are feeling this way. I am not a mental health professional, and this is way out of my capability. I urge you to call the suicide hotline or your therapist or a mental health professional. And this is very serious. Please get help. So that's usually, and there's kind of two different categories. There's the people that are having suicidal ideation and the people who are like, you know, if things don't get better by Thursday, I'm going to put a gun in my mouth. And so I do what I'm capable of, which isn't that much, which is to say you're not alone. So many of us are battling, and you are not doomed if you can just get help and keep trying to get help. Don't give up.
Would you say that your struggles with, it's anxiety and depression, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that those are the direct consequence of what happened in your childhood, or congenital factors, or a mix?
Well, I said to my psychiatrist one day, what exactly are the words for what I have? And he said, treatment-resistant depression due to childhood adversity. So he believes that's the case. You know, I believe being an alcoholic, which I believe genetically, I believe I could have been raised in a perfect environment and I would probably still be an addict of some sort. But I think the intimacy issues definitely have contributed to the depression and the anxiety, and I believe that that is a result of the abuse. But who knows exactly where it is? You know, a lot of the literature and the studies show that people who have been who have experienced incest have higher rates of depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, struggles with intimacy, and addictions.
and I have all of them.
Right. I was going to just ask you, how do you explain, given that potpourri that you just described, how did that lead you to comedy?
How could it not?
Maybe that's the healthiest. Yeah, the healthiest coping.
It was. It was how I survived as a kid. When I discovered the high of making people laugh, it was a way for me to be seen that was on my own terms. Because I wasn't seen as a kid. I was given attention, but it was unsafe attention from my mom. My dad was checked out. He was an alcoholic, high functioning, but he just wasn't present. He was there physically. So I think inside I felt like my only purpose is to please other people, because my only sense of self was from making my mom laugh. She would, by the time I was seven, she was complaining to me about how she wanted to leave my father, and she would break down and cry and I would have to comfort her. And then there were times like when I should have had somebody protecting me and she was just standing there, just not doing anything. And not that she never protected me, but the message to me was, you're on your own, buddy. And this wasn't a conscious message, but it was a feeling that I need to find love somewhere. And so my best tool at getting affection and attention was making people laugh. So I thought, this is going to save me.
And you're laughing. Why? Because it manifestly did not.
It validated a part of me. It validated the creative part of me. You know, there's a high in making a room full of people laugh for 45 minutes. But when you get off stage, you still have to face life, having difficult conversations with people. And I didn't know how to do any of those things. And comedy, no amount of comedy can help you in your interpersonal relationships. Most people get into comedy because they struggle with interpersonal relationships and they want to have the microphone. And it definitely helped me get a sense of self, but the most sense of self I've gotten has been from being sober, helping where I can, doing something for a living that has meaning and purpose to me, and just trying to live an honest life. And I make mistakes all the time, but I try to clean them up. I try to apologize where I can. And that has given me the feelings that I thought fame and money were going to come in. I like to joke that all the stuff that I've been through, and essentially difficulties that any of us go through, can oftentimes be a long-term gift in ugly wrapping paper. But if we don't get help, we don't get vulnerable, we don't connect to other people, we don't get to open that gift and experience that meaning and purpose. I don't wish the pain on anybody who's gone through something difficult, but I wish the tools that they may have to develop to survive, that they can then use in traffic, at work, in a relationship. You know, I had to do all those things to stay alive, but now I get to use them everywhere, like in traffic. I used to, somebody cut me off, I would follow them, challenge them to a fight, tailgate them. Nowadays, I don't take it personally. I just think, well, that person's probably self-obsessed, in a hurry, filled with fear. I know what that's like. God, I'm glad I'm not like that anymore. And I go from a flash of anger to gratitude. You know, I wouldn't have developed that tool on my own. So that's one of the gifts to me.
That's I think probably a very nice place to leave it. Before I let you go, though, let's do the plug zone. Let's tell everybody where they can find you in the world.
The website for the podcast is mentalpod.com. com. The podcast is called The Mental Illness Happy Hour, and you can find it on any of your podcast players. Yeah, fill out a survey on the website. Those are such a big part of the podcast. But yeah, give it a listen. There's some great episodes in there.
And are you on social media?
Oh, yeah, I'm so bad at plugging myself. At MentalPod on Twitter and Instagram. And Facebook page is facebook.com/mentalpod.
It's important work you're doing. It's I recommend everybody listen. It's really interesting and I think quite meaningful.
Right back at you, Dan.
Thank you.
Right back at you.
Okay, that does it for another edition of the 10% Happier Podcast. If you liked it, please take a minute to subscribe, rate us. Also, if you want to suggest topics you think we should cover or guests that we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. Importantly, I want to thank the people who produced this podcast, Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, and the rest of the folks here at ABC who helped make this thing possible. We have tons of other podcasts. You can check them out at abcnewspodcasts.com. I'll talk to you next Wednesday. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
I'm Shimon Liai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.